It's 6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO FM.
Coming up next, part five of a seven-part series called Angst at 40. KTOO News brings you this broadcast in collaboration with 360 North Television, the producers of this original oral history series. Today, host Nellie Moore is speaking with former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. This program has been sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage College of Business and Public Policy.
December 18, 2011, marks the 40th anniversary of the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It paved the way for construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and brought Alaska out of the Ice Age. But the politics that led up to the Act's passage included an intense period of negotiations, both in the nation's capital and here at home. All this at a time in our history when there was little transportation infrastructure or telecommunications, and nearly no television or news coverage of any type to inform all Alaskans whose futures would be impacted so much by passage of the Act. To analyze ANCSA and the pipeline is former Democratic Senator Mike Gravel. Gravel and the late Senator Ted Stevens served Alaska in the U.S. Senate during this hopeful yet tumultuous time.
That, you know, this is one thing that Ted Stevens talked about a lot through his career, was that, you know, a lot of people called it pork barrel spending or whatever, but like you were saying, there were so many needs that there was hardly any topic that you couldn't touch on where there was a need.
It was interesting that in my entire political career, my base of power politically was the Native community. And it was easy for me, from a moral point of view, whether I was in the state legislature or U.S. Senate, that anything the Natives needed, I was there 100%. And the logic of it for me was very simple. They needed so much, you could not make a mistake in going for things that they wanted for. Mm-hmm. And he, because of his seniority, now I left early, I was just two terms, and of course he was the longest serving Republican in the Senate history. And one of the things, and Ted and I, you may know, we used to fight like cats and dogs on issues. He was very close to Scoop Jackson, and as I was pointing out earlier, Scoop Jackson was extremely important in providing the leadership for statehood and also for the Native Claims Act. But he was also very much of a hawk on military matters, and so Stevens gravitated. He was closer, though he was a Republican, he was closer to Scoop Jackson than I was. In fact, Jackson and I had some really Donnybrook fights, and I had fights with Stevens over the whole attitude of creating a military-industrial complex that the great Republican of Dwight Eisenhower warned us against. So it's issues. I admired Jackson for what he did and worked with Stevens very close in what he did with the Native land claims, but and then later, as Stevens acquired greater seniority and on the Appropriations Committee, was able to create a fund that helped Alaska in many of its rural problems, whether it was fuel oil storage, you just name it, he was able to get that. Now, that was not boondoggle. Mm-hmm. That was what needed to be done in the rural part of Alaska, because the wealth that was going to be benefited to the American economy was going to come out of rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain justice that there's nothing wrong with using public funds to provide a base, a social base, an economic base for rural Alaska, because that was going to make this great national contribution via oil to the national economy.
How hard was it to sell that concept to others?
Very hard. It wasn't easy. And it was, one of the barriers was the racial problem. I don't want to overstretch that, but in the racial problems that we had in Alaska were not as severe as the racial problems that existed in the South 48, but they were touches of that. Because of the acculturation problem of the Eskimo, Aleut, and Indians coming into the American culture, it was so painful to them that, and you know, you'd see it on Fourth Avenue. The people that, let's say, couldn't make the change turned to alcohol. And it was just a very sad situation. And that poisoned the well, so to speak, and exacerbated the tendencies of racialism. All human beings have a racial mm-hmm. problem. But if you're in a minority, you can exercise your discriminatory powers. If you're in a minority, you just suffer the consequences. And so that's the climate that existed at the time. Let me put it another way that I think what people better understand it. When I was driving down Spinard Road yesterday, I was telling my wife, who had not had much experience in Alaska, and I said, this is what we used to call the Miracle Mile when I first came here, and it was a dirt road. They paved it the first year that I was here. Mm-hmm. And, of course, 4th and 5th Avenue in Anchorage were the only paved roads. Everything else was dirt. And we've come a long way.
Yeah, we
come
have.
A long way. And it's difficult as I drive around to see the level of change. And it's really because of the success of the resource industry in what was exploited in Alaska and the success of the native land claims. And this is what I hope a lot of the Caucasian elements or the Chamber of Commerce elements of our society, that what it did, when you raise rural Alaska, you are raising the rest of Alaska. It's like a tide.
Mm-hmm.
And they were up here, and rural Alaska was down here. You raise that, it's raising that also. Mm-hmm. And I hope they really understand how important it was in Alaska's history to really bring about justice to the indigenous people of Alaska.
You are listening to part 5 of a 7-part series originally created for television, ANCSA at 40. Host Nellie Moore is speaking with former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel about politics and the pipeline.
We've been talking about the discovery of oil in Prudhoe Bay and the land freeze by Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall and the necessity the oil companies are going, geez, we've got to solve this legal problem or we're going to have a problem too. We're not getting anywhere or we're not going to get anywhere. How did the natives, how are they able to come together and say, here's what we want, and when did they first approach you? I mean,
well, first off, they were supporting me politically because I was paying attention to them. It would not have come about had the natives not coalesced. Now, when I say coalesced, you got to understand that means coming together. That was not easy. You're talking about the Eskimos,
mm-hmm.
who didn't have great affection for the interior
Athabascan.
Indians, or the Aleuts,
mm-hmm.
who felt estranged from both, and then, of course, the Tlingit Haidas down, who were a little more warlike, but they were all warlike.
Mm-hmm.
People
historically,
you know,
they had been, and
well,
people,
had
a lot
whole
of people
history.
Didn't know that.
Well, I forgot, I once asked the resentment that was towards the white interlopers. I said, what did you do before we were on the scene? Oh, we fought among ourselves. You people came out. We would fight or have resentment towards you. But so there was a lot of that, and that was an enmity that goes way back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that enmity, though not violent, was still there and very suspicious. And so it was trying to get a handle as to how you saw that coalescing take place. I saw it because the reaction to the political community in Alaska, to the natives and to rural Alaska, that positive reaction, oh, this is a force out there. Well, the fact of recognizing and defining it as a force, the force came into being and grew. It's a human dynamic that was taking place where it grew, and as people were party to it, the various leaders, they were getting recognition. It's important for leaders to get recognition, otherwise they're not leaders.
Mm-hmm.
and so they got it, and then they recognized that they got more recognition as they looked stronger, and they looked stronger if they came together. And that's the pivotal moment was the AFN organization in 66. Because now they had an organization that became the clearinghouse for their this disparities mm-hmm. that existed. And so, and then by meeting and contacting and raising money and traveling and lobbying, it just all came together. The leaders at the time, you know, you had John Brobridge down in Southeast Alaska. Mm-hmm. You had Willie Hensley from your area up in Kotzebue, and Emil Nati. Now, Emil was an early leader, and because Emil had a disposition that was a natural leader. He didn't have to project himself. He was there, and he had a style of leadership that was very, very acceptable to the native community. And there were several leaders like that in Alaska. And I'm thinking of the fellow who was a bush pilot up in Kotzebue, who you may know became the general of the
National... John Schaefer?
Oh, yeah. A natural leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that the early leadership of the AFN with Emil Nati was extremely fortuitous. Had you had... And you had subsequent other leaders that were confrontational and vitriolic, and that was not helpful to interfacing with the white community or the political leadership.
Why was that? I mean, and, you know, it would have been a natural way to go. I mean, people could have said, well, he's not aggressive enough.
There's ways of being aggressive and there's ways of being unaggressive. In fact, Emil could do that, and he could do it without getting you angry. Other people in their confrontation, well, they'll confront you, and if they got the power, you'll agree. But if they don't have the power, you say, "Hell with you! I'm not going to pay you any attention." So that mode of leadership is not a very effective mode. The best mode of leadership is a natural personality who is got an intellect and will let you feel. Here, there's a Chinese proverb, and I think a Lao Tzu. A successful leader is one who makes it people feel that he's leading, that they are doing the leading.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the style of Emil Nati. And that set the tone. Willie has got the same kind of an approach, and so has John Brobridge. Now, at the time when I looked upon this as a native characteristic, but not really. As I developed more knowledge and matured myself, I could see that this was just a good style of leadership.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, these people were coming from really remote communities, from the far reaches of Alaska, coming into Juneau and then, of course, down to D.C. What was it like? I mean, trying to explain to them what they were going to have to go through, the legal issues that were involved. I mean, they hired lawyers. They had...
Oh, they were moving in to the legalistic society of American culture. And so if they were going to take care of their needs, they had to learn to play that ball game. And they learned it well. And so you had a lot of attorneys, like Bill Van Ness, who was an attorney for Scoop Jackson, was excellent. You had the Paul family. Both the father and the son were educated, were attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And so... They were able to bring their legal knowledge to focus on certain areas. These were the people on the cutting edge of it that were beginning to get involved. And then as the rest caught up to what needed to be done, as they coalesced and get the money to hire attorneys, mm-hmm. and they just had a lot of good attorneys in Alaska. Cliff Groh was a very significant Republican and was also a native attorney. They were really all over the place. Mm-hmm. Guy Martin, some were environmental attorneys, but everybody got in the mix, not the least of which, you know, I talk about the native leadership. Howard Rock,
mm-hmm.
who had the Tundra Times, but Howard's ability to provide the communication within the native community, which is sort of the glue, the mastic that brought it together and held it together as it matured and coalesced. That's the role that Howard Rock played. And I can't stress how significant that was. And again, Howard Rock was a personality type like Broadbridge and Iamonati. I mean, Howard was quiet. You know, you'd think maybe he's interviewing you and he's falling asleep. Not really, man. This guy was a volcano under this quiet, benign demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used his talent to, and he really wasn't educated. He was self-educated as a writer.
Right.
And so, but no, I would say that the element that brought about the coalescing was really the communications element that Howard Roch brought to the scene.
And at the same time, you were talking earlier, I mentioned a little bit about Anchorage and the, kind of the urban areas and a little bit of the disparity and some of the racial overtones that were tied in with ANCSA. How is this playing out in the chambers of commerce, things like this, and other groups of people that you also represented?
Oh, yeah. Well, keep in mind, I got elected in Anchorage on a plurality basis to the legislature. When I ran statewide, I never carried Anchorage. I carried the rural areas. I never carried Anchorage in any part of my Senate career. And so that's how it played out. In other words, I was viewed as in the pocket of the Native community. And basically I was. There's no question about that. But I recognized then that Alaska would never succeed until you brought about economic success within the rural areas. This is the example I was making, and I hope they appreciate it today, mm-hmm. because they sure didn't appreciate it when I first was a statewide figure. And that was that if you raise rural Alaska, you raise the urban areas. It's the tide. They were ahead, and you raise the bottom, and everything goes up. And that was very significant. There was a moment in time where this was driven home to the urban areas, and that was Ed Patton, who was the head of Alyeska, came to Anchorage and made a speech. Now, everything was tied up. The pipeline was tied up. Land claims were not satisfied. Everything was a mess.
Was the freeze still on at this point?
Yes, it was. And so Ed Patton, who I came to know and had several meetings with in a very interesting kind of way, he made a speech at the Chamber of Commerce. And he said, and of course these are businesses that are suffering in Anchorage, you know, so they're suffering and they're blaming it on the natives. That's really the dynamic that was going on at the time. And so he made a speech and he said, look, until we get the native land claims settled, we will not be able to go forward with the development of oil in Alaska, and Alaska will suffer. And so we've got to get our act together. Your community, the chamber community, has got to support the claims, and the oil industry's got to support the claims. Now, he was at the same time making that same statement, reporting that to his board of directors, which essentially were all these oil companies that had come together as a group and were financing Alyeska.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were getting that message at the highest level of the oil industry. He was giving that message to the highest level of the Alaska economic industry. And that speech was pivotal in changing the attitudes of urban Alaska in support, or I wouldn't say support, I would say either neutrality and some support. Mm. And this affected the Anchorage Daily Times. It affected the News Miner in the Fairbanks and in other parts of the state.
And it made headlines.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was hot stuff.
Yeah.
You are listening to part 5 of a 7-part series originally created for television, ANCSA at 40. Host Nellie Moore is speaking with former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel about politics and the pipeline.
Incidentally, let me give you a little segue on Patton. He, during the war, was a destroyer commander, was an engineer, and had built a big refinery down in California. And then when it came time to pick a person to provide the leadership to build the largest private undertaking in American history, they chose Ed Patton. I became acquainted with him when I had introduced an amendment to the to authorize the building of the Alaska pipeline, which was opposed by Scoop Jackson. And so he came to Washington with the lobbyists from the oil companies and asking me to back away from my amendment. And I said, no, I'm not going to back away. I said, look, I represent all of Alaska, and I'm making a judgment that the only way we're going to get the Alaska pipeline passed into legislation is not to try and slip it through, which Jackson had promised them, and I think was a phony promise, because Jackson was running for president. And he was more interested in satisfying the environmental community than satisfying the oil community. And so he said, oh, we'll take care of this issue in conference. Well, that means you're going to try to take care of this issue where the public can't see it. And I took the position that to deal with this issue, you need transparency. The American public has to understand its importance. And so I then had this legislation to get the Congress under the NEPA Act to approve the pipeline based upon these $300 million of studies that we were now ready to build it.
Right.
And so I then told them that, fellas, thank you, but no thank you. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I think, and I turned out to be right. He sent me a very personal letter, which is somewhere in the my papers at the University of Alaska. He sent me a letter, and he said, Senator, you were right. We were wrong.
Wow.
Because that's how we got the Alaska pipeline approved, was as a result of this confrontation, this doing it in the open, and people being persuaded that this was the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest is history. And of course, I feel, at the time, I felt I was just advancing the time frame of when we would build a pipeline. I now know that had we not secured the pipeline in 73, the approval in 73, we'd have never got it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the issue that came about after that was the D2 lands
yep.
issue.
Which is and, huge, and we'll talk about
that. That was
that.
It. That, you know, we were going from statehood to the Claims Act, then to ANILCA,
mm-hmm.
And of course, I fought the enactment of ANILCA because I thought it was excessive. I wanted to see a balance where we could protect our environment, and if we didn't bring about that balance, what you'd have would be the excesses. You go from one extreme of the pendulum, then you move back to the other, and you keep going back and forth. And the nature of governance should be one of balance,
mm-hmm.
where we permit people to make a living, to prosper, but not necessarily despoil the environment. And that's where the natives had a good handle on that, because they were, I would use the terminology, generically environmentalist.
They hadn't spoiled the environment.
No. Well, it's a whole different thing, and that's the reason why I was so unsuccessful in dealing with the Indian issue in the South 48, and it was more successful up here because there was no violence. But with respect to land, it has a religious, spiritual quality to it for the indigenous people, for the natives,
mm-hmm.
and also the South 48 Indians. It's a religion that is tied into this. The Caucasian community did not understand this. Our tradition comes from title and fee title. And so we own the land, in title, it's ours, we can do what we want with it. Well, the natives don't look at it that way. They look at it as a collective ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tied in with this spirituality and the religious overtones. And I did not understand this at the beginning. I've come to understand it as I get older and more mature, and it's very significant.
There were all these really diverse groups that were, you know, talking about this issue and trying to resolve it. What were some critical points in this whole debate? Were there some along the way that could have just killed ANCSA?
There were a lot of critical moments. Marlene
Johnson,
a good friend of mine down in the Southeast, I just thought the world of her. And she would hold me to task like anybody else, but I really thought she was a great leader. And she tells of a story now about that there was an incident where some skullduggery was going on in Washington. And I got wind of it, and I shared that information so the natives could react to it. I don't remember the incident. I really don't. And so I just don't remember all the details of it. And so I find, where was it? It was here on the Pentagon Papers with Dan Ellsberg and myself and a few other people, participants. You know, I remembered the way I think things happen. Well, I got together with Ellsberg, and then he remembered that differently. And I said, oh, my God, yeah, you're right. I was wrong. So we tend to, and it's probably intellectual self-preservation, we tend to view the issue from our enlightened self-interest and our preservation and our ego benefit. And so we, the mind distorts this, not intentionally. That's just the way human beings are.
Yep.
And so now when people ask me about elements of it, you know, I remember some of the details. If I was particularly involved, remember earlier I was saying, Nellie, that this issue seared my soul. It was so like it did with Udall. I remember those details very, very well. But if it weren't so damaging or painful to me, I probably would forget it. Now, this is not the case with the native leaders, because they were being exposed to a lot of painful confrontations that they had, and so they remember this very well.
Thank you for joining me for this special series of programs commemorating the 40th anniversary of the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971. For ANCSA at 40, I'm Nellie Moore.
This program has been sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage College of Business and Public Policy. You've been listening to Part 5 of ANCSA at 40, a 7-part series originally created by and for 360 North Television. If you missed any of today's program or would like to listen again, it will be posted on our website at ktoonews.org. You can also go online to find the broadcast schedule for the remaining episodes in the series. Again, that's ktoonews.org.
It's 27 minutes to 4. You're in tune with KTOO News. It's Pat Moore, your host for Juneau Afternoon today. Check that weather forecast again. Today is cloudy, scattered rain and snow showers going on right now. Snow accumulation, maybe an inch, and then it's going to have a high around 40, so it'll probably melt off pretty fast. Steady falling temperatures, maybe through the evening, winds up to around 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight we're looking at cloudy, scattered rain and snow showers through this evening, and then scattered snow showers tonight. Lows around 31. Light winds, and then Wednesday, mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers. Does this sound familiar to you? Highs around 31 and so forth. So basically about the same thing you've got right now all the way through Wednesday night. My guests in the studio now are talking about a set of public hearings that are going to help us decide what to do about the Capitol School Parkland, which is in the middle of downtown Juneau. With me are George Schaff, the Parks and Landscape Superintendent for the city, and the Principal Landscape Architect at Corvus Design, Chris Myrtle. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello, Pat. Thank you.
And so tell me about this set of public hearings that's going to come up.
Sure. Well, this is basically the first step in the development of a master plan for Capitol School Park, which is one of the largest parks in downtown Juneau and also one of the most heavily used parks in the entire borough. And what we are looking to do is talk to the users, talk to the stakeholders who are interested in the park over the course of these meetings and find out what they're looking for from the park, how they use the park, how they'd like to use it in the future. So it's a workshop. It's a design workshop, and then that's what we want people to expect when they come there is be prepared to work and to provide some comments and input.
Who are the stakeholders?
Well, it's pretty much anybody who uses the park. It's any member of the public, whether you use the park one day, if you haven't used the park yet, but maybe you will someday use the park. Capitol School Park is heavily used by some of the schools downtown. The Charter School and also the Discovery Preschool are both really heavy users of Capitol School Park. So, yeah, it's pretty much anybody in Juneau, anybody who visits Juneau who might find themselves in the park, anybody who has an interest in the park planning process should definitely come by.
Chris, is there an existing plan for use of the park?
There was a plan created back, I believe, in 1998 that I led. It was part of a nationwide celebration as part of the 100th year anniversary of landscape architecture. And I led that a long time ago, back in 98, and we came up with a community plan that really took what was a gravel parking lot with an ad hoc sledding hill on it, and working with the community. We have a similar set of public meetings like we're going to be having next week. Worked with the local users, the neighbors of the park, Parks and Recreation, and came up with several park master plans, and then we selected one, and then actually had a community build day, or weekend, I should say, where we spent a whole weekend with the neighborhood community, with Parks and Recreation, and we actually implemented and designed the park in the state it is now. But since then, it's become significantly more used. When it used to be a gravel parking lot, it was kind of general open space and when there weren't cars in there. But its success has unfortunately led to its deterioration. So we're at the point now where we need to upgrade it and really make it more usable for more groups that weren't using it previously.
If we were to do that kind of upgrade, what would be involved in the what would we have to do in order to bring the park to I understand you have to have the hearings first and find out what people want to do with it, but what would happen, how would you fix the gumbo?
Well, I think what's happening, as I said, is we've got far more users in the park that we didn't originally anticipate. The schools didn't exist, the Discovery Preschool didn't exist, and a lot of people used a lot of the trails to walk their dogs and so forth. Now it becomes a very convenient neighborhood community park, and folks at the Capitol are using it a lot too at lunchtime. Neighborhoods are using it for barbecues and picnics and birthday parties. So we're getting a lot more use than we ever originally intended. So I think what we really need to do is get back to basics and find out what are the primary needs, what's the common ground with all these different users, and really create a neighborhood park that makes it a public park for the community and for the people that live around it and use it on a day-to-day basis.
Now, this would be one of many park spaces that are around Juneau. Is there a plan that coordinates the use of all of those parks?
There is. The Parks and Recreation Department has a comprehensive plan that looks at our entire park system, and the park system encompasses everything from playgrounds and developed areas to natural area parks that really are forest land. There's very little development, if any, on some of those areas. And our park system is constantly evolving as we develop new parks, as we acquire new properties, as we receive donations. For example, the Jensen Olson Arboretum is a relatively new addition to the park system out the road. And so our comprehensive plan evolves over time. And about every 10 or 15 years, we try to do a complete overhaul of the comprehensive plan, look at it top to bottom and say, is this still the direction that we're wanting to go? And I believe that was most recently done about 5 years ago. So we're sitting pretty well with our comprehensive plan. And it's a really great document. If anybody wants to see it, it's available on the city's website at juneau.org/parkrec. And it talks quite a bit about the different facilities that we have, the different facilities that were identified through surveys that we need, the areas that need additional facilities or are being underserved currently. And it's really instructive, and it's the first thing that we look at when we're looking at developing park areas or how we manage and maintain the park areas that we have.
Chris, how does the existence of that comprehensive plan work with your landscape design process?
Well, George is going to be ruling with an iron fist, so he's going to make sure. No. comp plans are...
I've seen his cruelty here in the studio, so yes, okay.
Well, as George said, comp plans are living, breathing documents. They're always evolving. So they provide a guideline, and we may hear stuff that may be new information that we can build off of what's in the comp plan. So just because, and I'm not putting down the comp plan by any means, mm-hmm. but it forms a really good foundation for direction so that there's a big picture vision. And then from that big picture vision, what we'll do is then we'll take that information, what we hear at the public meetings, and refine that into a park plan.
How does Juneau's park and recreation plan, or the facilities, I guess, how do we compare to communities of our size?
Well, I think that when you look at some of the facilities we have, it really demonstrates the importance that recreation and outdoor recreation and access plays in our quality of life and the reason why I think a lot of people live in Juneau. You know, our trail system is a very important part of our park facilities. They're right up there with any developed facilities that we have, and they take quite a bit of work to develop and to maintain as well. you know, it's always a struggle. You've got, you know, the services that the city provides, there's a finite amount of resources. But I think over and over again that the people of Juneau have expressed their desire for park facilities, and it's pretty clear how important that is. And I think overall, we're incredibly fortunate to have the geographic setting that we have. We have incredible access right outside our back door to phenomenal natural resources. And a lot of our developed parks are in incredible settings, like Cope Park is just a tremendous scenic area in Evergreen Bowl. And that's pretty typical of a lot of our park facilities. So I think, you know, there's always room for improvement, but I think overall this is a pretty stellar system that we have here in Juneau.
How would this modification or the response to the public hearing and the plan, how would that be funded?
Well, we're not there yet. There are a lot of different options. A lot of our park improvements and maintenance projects are funded through the city's capital improvement program, which is how the city pays for major construction projects or renovations of facilities. The funding for those programs comes from a combination of sales tax, property taxes. There are grants available for some projects depending on what they are and how they're used. We do quite a bit of work with the Juneau School District for some of our park facilities. So when we have a park facility that's nearby a school or is used by a school program, we're able to work with the school district and the State Department of Education to fund those projects. So really, it depends. And the important thing and where we are right now is to get that clear vision so that as we move forward and we look at the funding sources, we know what we want to do, and that's going to instruct how much it costs and where the money comes from.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just to add on to what George said, I think the whole intention of this exercise is to create a revised, new and improved master plan for Capitol Park. And so we're going to be holding a series of three public meetings, and as we go through and refine what the master plan looks like, we're also going to come up with construction estimates, so we're going to know how much it is. So this not only becomes a tool for understanding what's going to Capitol Park is going to look like, but it also becomes a great tool for Parks and Recreation that they can then use that as a funding tool and find money so that the project can actually be implemented. So we're probably looking 2-3 years out before any ground really gets broken. We'd all like to see it happen sooner, but I think just in the reality, this is really the first step of coming up with a plan and then actual improvements to the park.
And that first step starts on February 28th at 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And
night.
The location, again, is in the Terry Miller building, the office building.
Yep, the Terry Miller Legislative Office Building, which is right next door to the park, directly behind the Capitol Building. And the entrance is up on 6th Avenue. And you can come right in, and the meeting's going to be in the gymnasium, which is in the center of the building.
So anyone who considers himself a stakeholder in the park or interested in this process should show up at the meeting the 7th, and then there will be two more after that as this ongoing process unfolds.
That's correct.
Well, thank you very much for telling us all about this. I'm sure that you'll see a bunch of people at your meeting on the 28th.
Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 21st of February, 2012. It's the birthday of Anais Nin, born in Douai, France, 1903, studied psychoanalysis, was a patient of Carl Jung at one time, wrote in obscurity for most of her life until her diaries began to be published in 1966, diaries that were written over a period of 60 years. It's the birthday of W.H. Auden, York, England, 1907, son of a physician, went to Oxford on a biology scholarship, switched to English literature. He met poets like Cecil Day Lewis, Stephen Spender, Lewis McNeice, who became his lifelong friends, and just before the start of World War II, emigrated to the United States to teach English. It was on this day in 1925, the first issue of The New Yorker came out, founded by Harold Ross and his wife Jane Grant, a reporter for the New York Times. Ross, the editor-in-chief, until he died in 1951. In the second issue, the editors published an apology for the first one. They said there didn't seem to be much indication of purpose, and we felt sort of naked in our apparent aimlessness. Circulation had dropped to 12,000 by the fall of 1925, but then it started to turn around after Ross hired E.B. White and James Thurber. Gradually, the magazine stopped dropping famous names and developed its own sensibility and style in short fiction and essays. The first cover featured a Victorian dandy in a top hat looking through his monocle at a pink butterfly, drawn by Ray Irvin, who also designed the distinctive typeface of the New Yorker. The man Eustace Tilley appears on the cover of every anniversary edition. It was in 1947, on this date, the inventor Edwin Land demonstrated the first instant camera, the Polaroid, the film layered with little sacks of developing and fixing solutions. So after exposure, the film was squeezed between two rollers, which burst the sacks of chemicals, and 60 seconds later, there was your picture. It's the birthday of the novelist David Foster Wallace, born Ithaca, New York, 1962, author of Infinite Jest, which became a bestseller in 1996, even though it was more than 1,000 pages long with 100 pages of footnotes. Wallace battled devastating depression his whole life, committed suicide in 2008. His unfinished novel, The Pale King, published in 2011. He said, "Postmodern irony and cynicism has become an end in itself, a measure of hip sophistication and literary savvy. Few artists dare to try to talk about ways of working toward redeeming what's wrong because they'll look sentimental and naive to all the weary ironists. Irony has gone from liberating to enslaving. The postmodern founder's patricidal work was great, but patricide produces orphans, and no amount of revelry can make up for the fact that writers my age have been literary orphans throughout our formative years." Here's a poem for today by Michael Lasky entitled Nobody. If you can't bring yourself to build a snowman or even to clench a snowball or two to fling at the pine tree trunk, at least find some reason to take you out of yourself. Scrape a patch of grass clear for the birds, maybe. Prod at your shrubs so they shake off the weight, straighten up. Or just stump about, leaving prints of your boots, your breath steaming out. Promise. Don't let yourself in for this moment again, the end of the afternoon, drawing the curtains on the glare of the garden, a whole day of snow, nobody's trodden. Michael Lasky's poem Nobody from Permission to Breathe, published by Smith Doorstep Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, sponsored by Constant Contact, celebrating the launch of Social Campaigns, a brand new social media marketing tool. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Support comes from the Juneau Empire's Job Fair, working to connect employers and employees March 21st from 2 to 6 p.m. at Centennial Hall. Information at JunoEmpire.com/jobfair.
It's 11 minutes to 4. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon, and my guest in the studio is Karen Smolin, who is the Technical and Education Coordinator for the Juno School District. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
We've had you on the show before, but February is a special month for you.
Well, February is the National Career and Technical Education Month, so I'm pleased to be able to share some highlights about things happening in our district.
Yeah, so what is happening in our district?
Well, let's see. Boy, there's a lot. So I'll just kind of run through some big highlights. First of all, each of our high schools is set up with career pathways. So students can take a series of classes that are connected to career areas and even earn an endorsement at the end of their high school experience on their transcript, supposedly in if they were interested in auto mechanics or in engineering or in construction or in culinary or business. There's just a variety, or health sciences, there's just a variety of career opportunities and exploration for students these days in our schools. So that's one of the first things, and our students have just finished registering for their courses for next year, and it's still not too late to even, you know, shift or pick that elective course that might meet an interest area. In addition, we have a lot of agreements with the University of Alaska system from UAS all the way up to UAF, where students can earn university credit for a high school class that they take. meaning our high school teachers have fully aligned their course to the university class. And what's really awesome about this is that the student earns their high school credit, but at a discounted rate of $25 a credit or $75 for 3 credits, they can start building a university transcript at an incredible rate. Typically, a course would cost $600, $700 at the university. So it's an opportunity for students to start, you know, saving a little money and building their transcripts towards an occupational endorsement or a degree program. And in particular, what I'd like to highlight about that is that right now, students, the registration period is opening, for several of the courses that they're taking at the high schools. And I'm hoping that if parents are listening, they'll remember to ask their student for the registration form. And here are some of the classes.
Okay.
Computer-assisted drafting, Creative Woods 1 and 2, Basic Instruction, Auto Mechanics 1 and 2, Intro to Health Sciences, Medical Terminology, EMT, Nutrition, Accounting 1 and 2. Did I say that one already?
No.
So there is an amazing array of opportunity here. And those particular courses that I listed out, those teachers just got the registration form so students can have their signature, their parents sign it, and they can register and pay for the class through their teacher.
So now these courses that we're talking about are high school courses. They're electives for the high school student.
Correct.
They would start when?
The courses started already. They started at second semester.
I see.
And they go through the end of the semester. And so the student automatically will earn their high school grade.
But they have to fill out this other form.
They have to fill out
the
registration form for UAS or UAA, depending on the school that we're working with for the course, to start building that transcript.
And pay the additional fee.
It's $75 for 3 credits,
right.
So it's pretty...
Most college courses are 3 credits.
So. Right. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah. And you can take more than one of these courses if you like.
Oh, yes.
The high school junior, you could take a course this term. And
sometimes students are in more than one class at a time.
Ah, okay.
And many of them, particularly in our construction trades program, a student can earn up to 24 credits in the occupational endorsement for the construction management program or the architecture, I forget what it's called, but there's a drafting program as well. So there's an opportunity for students to really start building towards it at a great
an incredible rate. Right. So you guys are building a house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's happening?
Well, here are some – this is the house build project is really one of our, I think, showcase programs for the district. For the last couple of years, and especially the last 2 years, we have been partnering with the Juno Housing Trust and SAGA and the Juno Construction Academy partners, which include the Home Builders Association, the University, Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, IBEW, CERC, and even the Job Center and Clinton and Hyde Housing Authority. Those are the key partners. I wanted to make sure I said them all. And we have jointly worked together to engage high school kids in a house build program. So we're building an affordable house where the housing trust is basically helping us keep things tight. Our design is a small bungalow ordinance-style house that the city has approved, and it's being sold to an affordable home buyer. And the housing trust is working with us very closely on that project. And we've got about 8 students engaged in the project, and we are building it on time. We just finished the house from last year this fall, and it's in the process of being sold. And we're planning for a house hopefully for next year. We're working on a land option. And there are students who we hope will consider joining the project next year. We have a nice, healthy class right now. In fact, several students, including those not in the class, are going to do a Habitat for Humanity house build project next over spring break. So there's a lot of interest, and it's great. Another really, and if you want to go see the house, it's on Lund Street in Lemon Creek.
And do you have to make an appointment or anything?
No. Well, you can look at the house from the outside. It's under construction, so it's a construction site. But the house next door is finished, and that's kind of the prototype of what it's going to look like, so you can get a pretty good idea. That house is locked. I can't let the public in at this time because it's in the process of being sold.
Right. Okay, and then do you have some students win a video, an award for video production?
Yes, our JD High School students just recently won an award with the Alaska Energy Efficiency Partnership. They did a PSA, and it came in third place, and the kids won shuffles, iPod shuffles, and the video club got an honorarium. And this PSA is now on their website at akenergyefficiency.org. But it was quite an honor for the video production class at JD High to earn that.
Do we know if it's going to air anywhere?
I would assume the partnership is handling that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
In addition, our digital arts class at Thunder Mountain High School has been doing some phenomenal work as well. And last year, at the end of the summer, at the end of the school year, they submitted a film project to this international film festival called Rotoball, where a ball would morph into something and morph back to the ball and then pass off to the next video clip.
Mm-hmm.
So this video was released last summer in China, and they played it this month at the Jump Film Festival here in town. The art class is also doing a collaboration project with the same teacher in China again to do a published book of surrealistic digital art images. And they're also collaborating on sharing digital art and the critique of it. So it's really neat to think what you could do online these days and with digital art in particular.
Junior Achievement's got a little news, too, I think.
It sure does. Our business class at Thunder Mountain High School partnered with Junior Achievement Project and the Woods class, and they created wood products, including cutting boards and beautiful crafted pens. And they formed a business, sold stock, sold the items, of course created it, sold the items, had a formal business plan, and even earned a nice little payback. But more than anything, they learned about the whole side of running a business and, you know, from soup to nuts,
mm-hmm.
and it was quite an honor.
And then you're going to tell us something about zero-hour classes?
You know, when students don't have room in their schedule, they've got a lot of required classes they must take. We offer in the district now a lot of before and after school classes. And we hope we'll continue this next school year, but we have several classes between both high schools that kids can grab, from accounting to all the way to CAD and even EMT training and advanced filmmaking. And a very unique partnership that we started this year is an intro to mining class with UAS, where high school kids are getting exposed to the opportunities in the mining industry here, earning credit, high school and university credit, and hopefully finding a pathway right into those training programs.
Well, these programs, I think, really benefit our students well. And, Karen, you're to be commended for the work that you obviously have put into to putting these successful programs together. Thanks for sharing them with us.
Well, thank you.
On Wednesday's show, you'll hear Kevin Krein from Alaska Powder Descents. Kathy Ruddy will be in to talk about the art of place, Wildlife Wednesday, and we'll find out about the latest at Eagle Crest with Writer's Almanac, music, and more. That'll be tomorrow at 3 on KTOO's Juno Afternoon. KTOO is translated throughout the area so that you can hear us around the mountains. We are on 104.3 FM, of course, here downtown in the valley in Auk Bay. If you tune your radio to 103.1, you'll hear K276AF relaying our signal. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, the signal comes in clearly at 101.7 on K269AO. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT can be heard in Hoonah at 91.9 in the surrounding area. In Excursion Inlet, Nicey Strait, KTOO is on K210AS at 89.9 megahertz. And in Juneau, you can receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We can also be our sister station, KRNN, is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. And you can also tune to us on our stream online at www.ktoo.org.